Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we've been talking a lot about mindsets lately, how to be more optimistic, how to use spirituality to deal with grief, recently how to turn your brain off for a vacation. Did you hear that last week? Well, my next guest has spent much of his life trying to overcome a negative, overly anxious mindset, and in his new book, he talks about how he does it. Daniel Smith is the author of Monkey Mind, a memoir of anxiety. Daniel, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's start with the title of your book, Monkey Mind. This has to do with a Chinese or Sino-Japanese expression, correct?
Yeah, it's a Buddhist term for a state of mind in which your thoughts and your emotions are completely out of control, like monkeys swinging in vines and screeching and doing all that distracting stuff that monkeys do.
So unsettled, nervous, capricious, uncontrollable, anxious.
All that stuff, anxious, exactly. I just thought it was a really evocative term, and so I borrowed it.
Now, you say that in the book, your main goal was to explain the experience of anxiety. What does it feel like? How does it affect everyday life? Is this why you chose to write about it as a memoir?
Absolutely. I'd been following books on anxiety for a long time, and I've seen and I own a lot of books about from a clinical perspective or from a therapeutic perspective, from a self-help perspective, and also philosophical books by Kierkegaard or novels that really represent anxiety. But I've never seen someone describe explicitly what it's like to live in a body hardwired for systemic doubt, for chronic anxiety, and how it affects every aspect of existence.
And there are different styles of that. For example, you write about how differently you and your brother Scott experience anxiety. For him, it's a very physical experience, but for you, it's more mental, you say. Can you explain the difference?
Sure. Poor Scott, I have to expose his anxiety. Scott, but I've already done it. Scott's a hypochondriac. So when Scott feels a twinge in his arm, he immediately thinks, this is cancer. This is the beginning of a heart attack. And this spirals him out of control. It reinforces the physical signal, which then makes him more anxious, but then reinforces the physical signal. And then before he knows it, he's in the back of an ambulance going to get checked out for what is usually just a muscle strain or some gas. Whereas I'm a ruminator. All my anxiety starts in my head and usually stays there, so that I think if I stub my toe, this is going to result through some cascade of mundane experiences to me becoming a drug-addicted homeless person on the street. I catastrophize, as they say.
Listeners, do you suffer from anxiety or have a loved one who does? How do you cope with it? What do you think about Daniel Smith's story, what you've been hearing so far, and his characterizations of anxiety? What can you say that might help others? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, Daniel Smith's new memoir called Monkey Mind, a memoir of anxiety. For you, one trigger for kind of setting up your pattern of anxiety in adulthood, and I think this is probably true for a lot of people, was college, going to college.
Yeah. I think it's a bigger problem than a lot of people realize.
Freshman year. Right out of the gate.
Straight out of the gate, straight out of the station wagon. Just all of a sudden, an explosion of anxiety. Because you're expected to be calm and collected. All of a sudden, you're confronted with all these strangers. And you can remake yourself, and that's a great deal of pressure. But also, it's the first time you're given a bit of real freedom to choose what you want to do, who you want to be. It's this clean slate. And freedom, as a lot of people who have written about anxiety, the philosophers have said, is part and parcel of anxiety. Freedom causes anxiety. At the same time, you're thrown into proximity with strangers. You've been living with your siblings and your parents, and then next thing you know it, you have to take showers with strangers. And that can be deeply, deeply disturbing.
Line from your book. Is this yours? Did you make this up? Freedom is anxiety's petri dish.
That's me. Not bad.
Do you think that's why we have so much more anxiety, at least being diagnosed, in our society today than there was, I don't know, 50 years ago, 75 years ago, because more people have more choices?
Well, that seems to be the prevailing theory, and I understand it, and I'm sympathetic to it in one respect. In another respect, I find it hard to believe that we're more anxious than any other era. You hear that phrase a lot, the age of anxiety. We live in the age of anxiety. And certainly we are aware of all the things that are wrong with the planet in a way that we never have been before. And certainly because of our prosperity, despite a recession, we still are more prosperous than society, say, 500 years ago. We have more freedom because of that. On the other hand, we don't have to worry about the Black Plague sweeping through Europe. We don't have to worry about roving hordes of mercenaries or hell in the way that, say, a European in the 14th century had to. And that anxiety, the anxiety of what's going to happen to me, it seems to me like something that would have been consistent throughout history. So I'm not quite sure how to answer that because I'm sympathetic to both poles of the argument.
So you think there is just some better diagnosis or more specific labeling of anxiety than there was in the past?
Absolutely. We're certainly more aware of it. Since Freud spoke of anxiety as the cornerstone of mental disturbance, there's been an explosion in writing about anxiety. There's been an explosion in talking about anxiety. And therefore, there's been an explosion in diagnosing anxiety disorders. So we know about it more. We're more aware of it. The irony there is that knowing about your anxiety and labeling it can also cause more anxiety. Mm.
Daniel Smith, author of Monkey Mind, A Memoir of Anxiety, 212-433-WNYC, and Jen in Basking Ridge. You're on the air. Hi, Jen.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask the author, do you have some – I only heard a part of your interview, but I was wondering if you have some practical tips in your book. My husband is a 40-something-year-old, has lots of, you know, anxiety issues and worry. And I'm wondering if beyond just commiserating with your story, if you have some, you know, practical tips in there or first steps he should take, things like that.
Yeah, hi. I do have practical tips, but not from the point of view of a clinician. I don't have training as a clinician, but I do talk a great deal about what worked for me and my own view of how to mitigate one's anxiety. And for me, it's all about habit. Anxiety, thinking anxious thoughts is a habit. It's like a track that your mind gets on. And if you're someone who has it as a chronic problem, your mind is always going to go back into those old habits. So the trick is to find a way to discipline your mind to work in a different way, to create new pathways. For me, two things have worked best. One of them is meditation, Buddhist meditation, because it trains you to be aware of these thoughts and to let them go. And the other pole of that is cognitive therapy, cognitive behavior therapy, which teaches you also to be mindful of these thoughts, this sort of talking to oneself that you might not be immediately aware of, but that's going on all the time. And then to question your assumptions, to question these things that you're telling yourself. I'm worthless. Everything is going to go badly. This stub toe is going to result in this and this and this. You could submit test to it almost as like it's a scientific proposition. What are the chances that this is actually going to happen to me? And if I'm practicing that on a daily basis, then I'm far less anxious. It's all about discipline and changing the habits of your own mind, in my experience.
Jen, thank you very much. And I hope some of that is useful for your husband and other listeners. Maybe some of that is useful to you. And that was a very cogent explanation, both of some of the underlying mechanisms that kind of become habits in an anxious person and how you've dealt with them. Would you say that you've had a lot of success in conquering or coping with your anxiety?
I had an enormous amount of success with cognitive behavior therapy. The book begins and ends with a therapist that I had in my 20s who used this discipline. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know the name of it, but it helped enormously. It was transformative. And then, like a lot of people, I started to feel better and then stopped practicing. There's a pigheadedness about a lot of these practices. Same thing happens to me with meditation. Once I stopped being anxious, I stopped doing the things again, and then I have to remind myself all over again. But while I'm doing them, they've been enormously helpful. I feel like a different person. I feel far more capable of dealing with daily life.
And by the way, you write in the book that in 16 years of anxiety, you've had six therapists. Five out of the six have been almost completely ineffectual, like taking aspirin for leprosy, you write. So what was it about the sixth therapist that made him so effective? And what do you think people suffering from anxiety should look for when they're interviewing people who they have no idea other than, you know, maybe they're recommended or they're on a piece of paper from their insurance company when looking for a therapist?
Well, that's how I found this therapist, Brian. I just happened to get lucky and I went to Brian. And what made him different than previous and also most subsequent therapists is, as I say, that he had a system. He had a theory. And that theory of cognitive behavior therapy has been shown empirically to be extraordinarily useful for the anxiety disorders. The other therapists, almost all of them, the ones that I mentioned there, those five, like most therapists, were what is known as eclectic. They did what most therapists do, and they wanted to talk it out, release the sort of valves of your own problems, just try to talk it through. But there wasn't any effort to really change the patterns. There wasn't any systematic effort, and I wasn't empowered to do those things. With cognitive behavior therapy of the sort that I got, and it also might have been simply the case that we jived. That's an important thing in therapy, that finding someone with whom you have a rapport. But there was homework. There was something that I can go off and do and question these assumptions that are running through my head. And so that when I left, I was, in essence, my own therapist. And I could keep doing what I learned how to do. It was a re-education, basically. Mm.
So we talked earlier about too much freedom leading to anxiety. Maybe for Mike in Hillsborough, not so much. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say, and maybe it's what I read and watch, but I feel that we don't have all the freedoms that we should have. For example, I mean, gay marriage. That's a freedom that people should have, and we shouldn't be, you know, dealing with that issue on a political scale. So I feel it's the complete opposite. I feel that we have privileges, and we don't necessarily have freedoms. And I feel like that's what causes my anxiety, is the fact that I can't change those things. It's within society. How would you cope with that? I mean, I stopped watching some news outlets because of the doom and gloom that they always preach. And it's like, that's my short-term effect, but at the same time, I'm not being informed properly with the media as well. So, I mean, I'm just curious, where exactly do you draw the line? I mean, you want to be an informed, intelligent citizen, but at the same time, when certain news outlets are always preaching, you know, another war, the whole, you know, Israel-Iran conflict, all this thing, another nuclear war. You know, I mean, it's like, where do you really, you know, stop and actually try to get a solution for that anxiety?
It's a great question, and I wish I had a good answer to it because, you know, a person wants to be responsible and you want to be aware of what's going on in the world. And at the same time, you're right. It could be enormously anxiety-provoking to pay attention to all these things. I remember sitting around working on this book, and I turned on the radio while I was cleaning up my office, and they mentioned that this new study had shown that the particulates from laser printers were shown to be carcinogens. And I had been printing out a manuscript all day, and I just had that flush of anxiety of, there's nothing that isn't a carcinogen. What am I supposed to do? I'm so out of control. The same thing with climate change, with global warming. It causes me an enormous amount of anxiety, especially as a parent of a 5-year-old who's going to be growing up in this world that I can't protect her from these horrible forces, from terrorism, from nuclear proliferation, from global warming. One has to, I suppose, have the perspective of what control you do have and what control you don't have. You can't on your own stem the tide of global warming. You can do what you can do. You can live a good and ethical life. And beyond that, you do have to let go while still continuing your whole life to act in a positive way. Beyond that, I'm not sure I have any answers. If I did,
I think that you're right. And people who have particular susceptibilities to anxiety from focusing from their empathy, really, with the world. Sometimes people do need to take news holidays.
Yes.
And realize that the media, you know, a show like this included, focuses on the problems in the world and the conflicts in the world because we're interested in trying to solve the problems in the world. And that's a good thing. And some people are empowered by this information and the ability, you know, the means that we might discuss for people to act. But on the other hand, some people might at some times be just made depressed by it or anxious. And I think there's nothing wrong with taking a news holiday from time to time.
No. And at the same time, though, you don't want to let go of that empathy. But you do. One does have to live and not think of, you know, coal-fired power plants every time you switch on the lights and live in darkness. It's a tough problem. I'm sympathetic.
You mentioned in your book, by the way, that one of the things you do to alleviate anxiety, a bout of severe anxiety, is that you watch Singing in the Rain. So we asked on our Facebook page, what do you watch? And we got some cool responses. Erica watches The Princess Bride and Field of Dreams and A League of Their Own. Brenda watches Singing in the Rain as well, she says. Also On the Town, Birdcage, Funny Girl. Shupa watches Matilda. Eric says Twitter you to unwind or half-baked. Helen says Let It Ride, a little known but lovely Richard Dreyfuss racetrack comedy. And she says, I can't explain the effect this film has on me, but invariably it makes the world seem less bleak.
I'm going to take all those suggestions and go out and get some DVDs.
Sheila in Larchmont, you're on WNYC. Sheila, we don't have much time for you. Can you do it in a soundbite?
Okay. Your guest is an expert. He should never put himself down. I believe that no one is actually born with anxiety. What I have found in my practice is that very often as a young child, they will emulate a parent and try to release the parent from the parent's anxiety burden, and they take on the parent's anxiety. So they're dealing with anxiety that isn't even their own.
Yes, and you, this is, and Sheila, forgive me for cutting you short, but everyone in your family suffers from anxiety, according to your book. Your father once sought refuge in a psychiatric facility. Your mother went back to school to become a therapist to deal with her own anxiety. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this would be learned behavior.
Yeah, but at the same time, I don't want to put it all on my poor dear mom. I do believe that there's a genetic component as well. Why shouldn't there be if there's a genetic component for basically everything? And yes, part of it's learned behavior, and part of it, I know that I was an anxious kid very early on that I struggled with this. So I'm willing to see both sides of it.
My guest has been Daniel Smith, author of Monkey Mind, A Memoir of Anxiety. He has readings Wednesday at the Book Court in Brooklyn and Thursday at Book Review on Long Island. Check out our webpage, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer's show for more details about his appearances. Let's see, watching Singing in the Rain. You have other tips. Calling a friend who's even more anxious than you are.
Oh, yeah. Makes you feel actually sane by comparison. Always works for me.
And you're not anti-medication, right?
No. I took my medication this morning.
All right.
Whatever works.
Really, really useful and so, you know, so thoughtful and well-organized, whether you're a trained psychologist or not, and obviously useful for a lot of our listeners. So, Daniel Smith, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.